I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay, and tonight we are taking a look at the boat building industry, both in Bristol and in Rhode Island. We're coming to you from the Bristol's Elks Lodge, 1860, here on the beautiful Bristol waterfront. The industry, as one boat builder put it, got whacked during the 2008 economic downturn. Scores of businesses went belly up, and many adapted, though, and are now seeing growth. We'll start this evening by looking at what's happening on the front lines. Ben Hall is vice president of Hall Spars and Riggings, one of the best in the world at making boat masts, booms, and all the rigging that goes along with owning a sail. Also joining us is Wendy Mackey, the CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, who is continually taking the pulse of the industry. So, Wendy, we'll start with you. What happened to the boat building industry when the bottom dropped out of the economy in 08 and 09?
Well, I think probably the same thing that happened in every industry. Employers needed to figure out where they could cut costs and downsize to the point where they could manage themselves. We did lose several businesses at that time. But the ones that were able to make it through the recession actually started emerging much stronger.
What percentage of the industry would you say that the downturn wiped out?
If you're talking specifically boat builders, or if you're talking the entire industry, it's a little bit different. It's hard to say. But boat builders specifically, it was around half.
And how did this compare to, say, the marine services industry, those who run marinas and perform services?
Well, like marinas, that's why I was asking, which sector are you talking about? Because marinas themselves, we started with 111. We still have 111 in the state, not in Bristol alone, but yeah. So very even. Sometimes they had to reduce the size of their staff, but they all maintained business.
And what did the marinas see? Were there fewer boats docked? Were there fewer customers?
Yes, definitely. I think that's not specific to the marine industry necessarily, but definitely. There were open space, open moorings, open docks. It's in some capacity, but it depends on where the location was, what they were doing for marketing, the level of their clientele, that sort of thing.
So Ben Hall is a businessman in the trade, long time, I must say. Well, what did you experience?
I think talking to Catherine the other day, in 2008, it was for us kind of like falling off a cliff. I mean, it happened. It was a very rapid turnaround. We went from 96 employees down to 55 in a matter of months. And our business from 2007 to 2009, it dropped about a half. But, so we had to downsize quickly and adapt. Unfortunately, we had built a very nice new building in 2005 with the help of the state. And our job was to fill that place up. And we had it going very nicely in 2006 and 2007. But September 2008, like I said to Catherine, it's almost like getting hit in the head with a baseball bat. But, we're still here today. We've adapted and actually found, a way to hopefully make the company stronger.
And how did you adapt and diversify what you do?
Well, just recently, we've always done some things out of the marine industry because people would ask us, can you make this? We were kind of reactive marketers in that respect. But we can, when it comes to composites, we can make just about anything. But this year, in January, we did a concerted effort with a whole new division, Hall Composites, and actively went out to market our abilities in manufacturing. We've had very good success from different shows around the country that we've gone to this year. And I think, right now we've got business in aerospace, in military, in architecture, and in some other recreational sports that aren't sailing. So,
and Ben, I think you were telling me you make chairs. You're looking at making a gate for a zoo?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny what comes from these shows. We went to a show in Orlando, a general composite show, and a young designer from Miami came up to us and said that he had a really cool design for sort of a modern Adirondack chair, and could we make it in carbon? And I had actually been thinking about something pretty similar, and we did. And that was actually our... We used that chair at the show we were just came back from in Boston, and it was like a magnet into the booth. And it just shows people that we're not only can make really nice sailboat masts, but you could make a chair that would go in the Museum of Modern Art. It's absolutely gorgeous.
You know,
and,
my...
excuse me. the elephant gates, that was another one. That came out, we went to an architectural show in Denver in June, and it was a huge show, huge show. And Pete Levesque, who is heading up our composites division, and I were sitting around. It's like, what are we doing here? I mean, you know, all the cement block and steel and everything. And it turned out to be one of the best shows that we went to. We just had no idea. And one of the outcomes of that show was a guy that lives in Barrington who's got a whole bunch of patents on different gates and came to us and asked if we could make these specialized lightweight gates to contain elephants in zoos. And it's like, wow. That's right out of left field, and but apparently there's a big need for it and for the safety of the handlers, and we've developed some parts for him that they're actually going to probably put into a sanctuary that's in Pittsburgh, and that's only the start.
From mass to elephants, that's really interesting. But by diversifying and taking jobs for other sectors, as you mentioned, architecture, the military, aerospace, how did you retrain your workforce to be able to handle this extra kind of work?
Well, first of all, we're not getting out of the sailboat, you know, the yachting business.
Of course not.
That's still the core business. That's still what we love. But most of the projects we're doing, interestingly enough, we have to educate our customers because we know more than they do about composites. So very little retraining is needed with our workforce. But the one thing we've found in the aerospace industry is they're insisting that we go ISO 9001, and that's going to take retraining of our people. Because
now, what would that mean in lay language?
ISO 9001 is a worldwide certification that basically it's a quality certification that basically says you've written down every process in your company that you do, and it's in a manual, and you have to abide by it. And it's tedious work, but it's necessary. It's it's a box that you have to check for the aerospace industry, but it will also probably be helpful in the future for the mega yacht business in Europe, because a lot of insurance companies will insist, or we might have an advantage over another competitor who doesn't have it.
Now, your design process, is it a two-way work where you're sitting down with a customer and agreeing on a design, or is the customer dictating the design and you build to the specifications?
We do both. A good example of working with customers and their designs is the America's Cup. We've made the, not this last time, but we've made the winners for the last three America's Cup boats, and worked with a whole bunch of different designers that we build to their design. They might come and say, well, how do we make this part? And we might help them with that. So that's one, and in the aerospace stuff, we're building to their exacting designs, every right down to the last, you know, dotting every I and crossing every T. But most of our customers, we do all the design work. We have 7 engineers on staff, and we do all the laminate design. And even companies like Lockheed Martin, who we've worked with, we've taught them, you know, how to make some very, very big tubes, which they couldn't really figure out how to do. So a little bit of education both ways, and we like that.
I take it the design nowadays, unlike the old days, is mainly CAD, computer-assisted kind of designing?
It's, yeah, I mean, it's funny. You think back even, you know, 20 years, and everything used to be hand-done. Now it's all AutoCAD, SolidWorks, CATIA. I mean, very, very sophisticated software that we're using now and in helping us design our product.
So in 147 characters or less, how are you doing, Ben?
It's funny, you know, because I think, Catherine, I talked to you, was it last week?
Mm-hmm.
And just this last week, you know, typically the fall in the marine business gets pretty quiet. Boats are coming out of the water, but we've had a barrage of, inquiries, and you know, we've got, it looks like we're about to sign a whole bunch of business. So things are, I think, starting to be an uptick, and we just got back from a big show in Monaco, and looking at a couple of very large orders from Europe. And also, the one thing that the spinoff of the downturn has been that instead of people buying new boats, they're spending a lot of money on their existing boats. Mm-hmm. And there's one race boat out in San Francisco that had a full complement of our carbon fiber mast that we built just 4 years ago, and they want a whole new set because they can save 16 pounds on the rig.
So things are looking a lot better than in 08.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Excellent. You're listening to a special program looking at the state of the boat building industry as part of our series, One Square Mile Bristol. We're talking with Ben Hall, Vice President of Hull, Spars, and Rigging, and Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association. It's being recorded at the Bristol's Elks Lodge on Bristol's waterfront. I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay. So, Ben, from my conversation with boat builders, it sounds like your business, it's coming back to life. Shannon Boats has a help wanted sign out in front of their business. And I think you were telling me there's a fellow boat builder who built 300 J boats last year.
Yeah, probably, we talk about all the boat builders that are, you know, that were missing from 2008. But I put a list together today of boat builders, not necessarily right in Bristol, but within a few square miles. And I came up with a number of 14, and those are off of our customer list. And that's not bad. And they're not all big ones, but I think the star of the boat builder thing is CNC Fiberglass right in Bristol. And he last year built 300 J70s, which is a new 22-foot boat, very great success story for J boats. But along with that, a 36-footer that we've now built in the last couple of years, over 100. And that's come right out of CNC Fiberglass. And, you know, there's a bunch of other small builders who are doing well. Resolute, I'm not sure how Outer Limits is doing these days, the powerboat manufacturer. But, you know, there's a lot of other builders around that are, I think, starting to see a little bit of action.
You know, I don't know the manufacturing aspect and how much production's going on, but what I hear a lot about is workforce development and who's hiring and who needs more people. And there is definitely an uptick in how many people are hiring, how many people are needed. I do agree.
So do you think then, Wendy, this has been a fragile recovery, or have the gains been consistent, and you think the projections are healthy?
Oh, I definitely think the projections are healthy. Again, I refer a lot to how the hiring trends are going. But it seems that, you know, companies that have made it through the recession have been able to diversify and really become stronger because of it, diversifying their revenue streams.
Excellent. Well, we're going to have to cut the conversation off here for now. Ben Hall, Vice President of Hull, Spars, and Rigging, thank you for joining us. When we return, we'll take a look at what's being done to boost the boat industry in the state. This is a special program looking at the state of the boat building industry as part of our series, One Square Mile Bristol. You're listening to Rhode Island Public Radio, Rhode Island's NPR. Good evening. I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay, and we're taking a look at the boat building industry, both in Bristol and in Rhode Island. We continue the conversation looking at what's being done to boost the industry, not just in Bristol, but across the state. Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, has stuck around to join us in this conversation. And joining us is Paul Harden of the Rhode Island Economic Development Corporation. Paul, welcome, and we will start with you. Where does the boat building industry rank in the state? How big a sector is it compared to others?
First, thanks, Catherine, for having us here tonight. The boat building sector and the related marine trade sector, which covers areas other than just pure boat building, it's not a huge sector compared to retail or healthcare or sectors like that. There's probably about 6,000 to 7,000 jobs in the marine trades industry, which covers everything, including boat building and all the support. You know, one of the things about the marine trade sector is Rhode Island is known worldwide. And I think Ben Hall earlier mentioned, you know, they have customers from around the world. And Rhode Island and the East Bay and Aquitic Island is known as a center for the marine industry. We have, you know, a very specialized workforce here and very specialized companies that, that deliver services to, you know, boats and yachts from around the world. So while it's not a huge sector, it's an important sector. Another point, in sector economies, you try and have sectors that have all the support industries. And that's one thing we do have here in Rhode Island, is we have, you know, a supply chain that's probably unparalleled on the East Coast of marine-related companies, all the way from, you know, naval architects to the companies that do the tooling, to the companies that do the molding, to the companies that, you know, install and repair electronics. We have companies that do marine upholstery. We have rigging companies, so it's unlike many other parts of the country.
Is there a dollar amount that we can put, this is how much it brings into the state, or this is how much it bills?
There are a couple of different surveys that have talked about the numbers around the marine trades. There's a 2008 skill gap study that RMTA did with support from the Governor's Workforce Board, and then the National Marine Manufacturers Association did a study. And they show numbers anywhere from about $260 million to $175 million. We're in the process right now of doing another skill gap study that will update a lot of these numbers. And I think what we're seeing is, as each successive survey gets more accurate, and we're beginning to make sure we're hitting all the sectors. One of the other things we've seen, too, is there's a lot of spin-off business coming out of the marine trades in terms of people, you know, using restaurants on the waterfront and things like that.
Excellent. So, Wendy, the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, it takes regular surveys of its members. What are the employment numbers looking like?
Well, the most recent one we did, and again, this is an informal study of just our membership of about 250 at the time. We had 51 responses in January. And of those 51 responses, 110 new positions were created in 2012. And so those were like hard numbers. They had already happened. And then they projected, those same 51 companies projected 84 new positions for 2013. As Paul said, we're going to be doing a skills gap analysis this year, so we'll have some really crisp, good numbers probably in January. An interesting question we asked them, too, is how many years have you been in business? And just to kind of show you the stability of this industry in Rhode Island, 28 was the average number of years that companies were in business. And I just think that's very neat. You know, it shows some of the history, and that's the average. So there's a lot of new ones in there, too.
You know, Paul, since the days of the Greenhouse Compact, which, of course, was that attempt to steer some state investment to promising industries, was voted down, of course, in 1984. But Rhode Island's been talking about growing the marine trades industry. It's almost become a cliche. So what's been done, and where's the room for growth, and what more needs to be done?
I agree with Scott. We've been talking about it for many years, and we'll continue to talk about it for many years. One of the big things, one of the competitive advantages we have here in Rhode Island is there's no sales tax on boats that are purchased here. Every few years, that comes up as an issue in the legislature, and the marine industry, with RMTA, you know, keeps that the sales tax off the boats. It's something that other states wish they had. I mean, I've had people from Maine and Mass say, we wish we were as progressive as Rhode Island in that, and that's, you know, something you don't see very often. And one of the big pluses about the sales tax is, you know, to maintain the non-payment of sales tax, you must keep your boat here in Rhode Island. And it's almost as if it's an annuity because you get the storage work, you get the service work.
So you create a captive industry.
You do. And you capture the clients in the state, too. You know, we're also working to develop possible sites on the waterfront. One example of that would be some land that's currently owned by the Navy in the Melville area. We've been working on that for a number of years.
Well, they built PT boats, didn't they, many years back?
I think they trained PT boats.
They did. John,
yes.
Kennedy
yep.
Got his training
yes.
at Melville.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's areas we're looking at. We're looking at how do we better market the marine industry in areas and expanding workforce development in the industry, and we've got a couple of schools now that specialize in the marine training.
Now, what are the jobs we're talking about? We know they're skilled jobs. These are well-paying jobs, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and they're an incredible range of jobs, both in the boat building sector, where people are just, not just, but are fabricating boats, and then they've got jobs in the service sector where people are repairing jobs. The salaries, on average are probably in the $40,000 to $50,000 a year range. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we have an incredibly experienced workforce and an incredibly specialized workforce.
And there's room for growth in this industry.
Yes, yes. As people gain additional training, they move up and they become managers and supervisors at many companies. One of the areas we're talking to many companies about is cross-skills training, mm-hmm. to make sure their employees are trained in multiple areas so they can be more versatile. Mm-hmm. We're looking, and RIMT is working very actively on how to introduce young people and bring new workers into the industry.
And we'll be talking with Iris about that,
yes.
later on in the program. So I want to shift gears just a little bit. Wendy, who is Rhode Island's competition? Is it Connecticut? Is it Maine? Is it China?
Well, it's all of them, but I also think of it as nobody. I really wish, actually, that we were able to work a little bit closer together, so that we could share the boating traffic here and there. But, I think Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Connecticut, if I had to choose.
All right. And speaking of competition, whereas Bristol would have a company like Gertz Boats that actually works on America's Cup boats, Newport has the America's Cup Boulevard down there. Is there a friendly rivalry between Bristol and Newport? Is there a little competition?
I'll take that. I think there is a competition. We had the America's Cup in World Series in Newport last summer, and we're having the Volvo Ocean Race stopover in May of 2015. But I think to bring these events to Rhode Island helps the whole area and helps the whole sector. So while parts may be made here in Bristol, and the boats are racing in Newport, and people know Newport, and that helps bring people to the event.
Mm-hmm. Seems like Newport gets a lot of the America's Cup love when actually a lot of the work is happening here in Bristol.
Well, I think for 50 years, Newport was the home to the America's Cup races, not every summer, but every three or four summers. So I think that history.
Yeah, the Harris Shop is here.
Yeah.
That's right. You're listening to a special program looking at the state of the boat building industry as part of our series, One Square Mile Bristol. Sorry. We're talking with Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, and Paul Harden with the EDC. I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay. Now, Wendy, Rhode Island's pretty well known to boaters as a tax haven. We touched on this briefly earlier, but can you, for the uninitiated listener, run through exactly what is tax-free for boaters?
Right. So if you buy your boat here and you keep your boat here, there's no sales tax on that boat. There's no and there's no sales tax on the service. There's also no property tax on the boat. So it's literally a tax-free vehicle for yourself. Yeah.
John Kerry, of course, the senator and now Secretary of State,
we all have to hear about
made
that.
Some big news a few years back when he was docking his $7 million yacht in Rhode Island and saving a huge chunk of change, I think it was about $500,000, in taxes. Obviously, this tax policy has helped the boating industry, but do you think you could absorb a minor tax increase such as what Governor Lincoln Chafee planned back in 2011? It was a 1% tax on sales and repairs?
No, absolutely not. Do you agree?
No, I would agree. Yeah. It's Rhode Island's known for this area, and
exactly.
I think the concern at the time was if you start at 1%, why don't we go to 2%?
Yeah,
well, and it's sort of a creeping approach to it.
And you had asked, who's our competition? Connecticut, Massachusetts, the other New England states. They look at us as their competition because we have tax-free boats here, and they all are working for it themselves. Every other marine industry association in those other states are trying to get what we have. If they ever get it, then there will be more competition for us. Right now, we don't have any.
Switching gears a bit, what is the state of Rhode Island's working waterfront? A lot of states along the eastern seaboard, I'm thinking the Carolinas, Florida, they're fighting fiercely to keep condos from encroaching in on their working waterfronts.
Do you have a sense how many miles we're talking about? Are there any marinas that are at risk of becoming condominiums? What is the state of the state's working waterfronts?
The working waterfront is an issue that we're concerned about. And there are certain key areas in the state.
Providence,
Allens Avenue area.
Yes.
The challenge is, you know, if you move a lot of the resources that are there currently, is where are you going to put them? And the cost of moving products such as salt and other petroleum products, trucking them inland, is more than what you spend to get the product here originally. So we are actively involved in that. We've seen a few areas in the state that were working waterfronts become housing.
Where?
The Mount Hope Marine Terminal in Bristol is one example.
Newport,
over the years. I mean, at the last America's Cup in '83, there were probably half a dozen different shipyards along the Newport waterfront, and now there's one left. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, most people see a condo development with a marina out in front the same as a boatyard, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see what Newport Shipyard has done in Newport in developing that area and really becoming a center for the large yachts. But it's an area we're looking at, and we really don't want to see, once you make it housing, you're never going to convert it back again.
Mm-hmm. So. And Wendy, are you hearing of marinas protecting other marinas or keeping an eye out to make sure they don't convert over to condos? Yeah. Actually, there's two that I can think of right now that are taking place. Just somebody, a marina becomes available and another marina owner or somebody from the industry is buying it because they want to continue to operate it that way. And I can think of a few that have happened recently in the last couple of years as well.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that once you let housing in condos, and a lot of folks live right next to, say, somebody who's painting boats 24 hours a day, well, those people are going to vote and they're not going to want the noise and the lights and everything else from the industry next door that's working in your business.
No, I would agree with that, and it's something we were concerned about as there was discussion about building condominiums and other housing along the Providence waterfront when companies like ProMet were operating along the Providence waterfront. But it's they're in many ways incompatible uses of having boatyards next to condos and other developments.
Mm-hmm. So what is the EDC doing to help kind of pump some life into the working waterfront industry, the marine trades industry? Are you seeing some bright spots that you're really focusing on?
I mean, one of the constant challenges, as we talked about before, was the issue over sales tax and keeping that available for the marine industry. We're working on gaining access to the Navy land at Melville. There's some other waterfront property in Newport the Navy will surplus, hopefully the next couple of years, around the Newport Naval Hospital that has the potential for marine development. And then also we're working very closely with the Department of Environmental Management on improvements to Fort Adams State Park to make that a more suitable facility for a wide range of marine events. As we mentioned earlier, we had the America's Cup there, and DEM has put probably $4 or $5 million into improving that facility in terms of the waterfront, is hosting things like that.
And what about for business owners or like Ben Hall or someone who wants to become the next Ben Hall? Are there incentives or loans? We report on these for the green industry here in Rhode Island. Is there anything for the owner?
We don't have loans targeted just for the marine industry, but we do make loans available to marine-related companies. And we're talking to a couple right now. About different financing programs we have to acquire facilities. We work with them helping find sites. We work with them on recruiting workers through the Department of Labor and Training through their programs. So we work with a wide range of marine industries. We also work with our travel and tourism hospitality people in developing tours to bring writers and bloggers the blog on the marine industry to Rhode Island to feature it as a destination for boaters. Mm-hmm. We also did an industry tour last year where we brought in a number of writers from trade publications to show them what went on in Rhode Island. So,
did the Little Bristol tour.
Yeah.
And explain the Little Bristol tour. Oh, it was great, actually. We had, I think, 12 different writers from different trade magazines that came. We took them on a little trolley tour. We went to Hall's Bars. We started there. We went to Cam Molding.
Mold Cam.
Yeah. Sorry, Mold Cam. We went to see Eric Gertz. And then we took them past the Harishoff, went to Portsmouth to the Melville section, and then over to Newport, and did a few places over there too, including the shipyard.
So places like Bristol is almost like a virtual boat building company in one town.
Oh, yes. Bristol is like a virtual boat building company.
Go get your sails at Quantum. Go get your rigging over at Ben Halls. Go get your hulls from a variety
from
of places.
Right, exactly.
And then go hit the pub for your drink afterwards. You're
perfect, right. Or the yacht club, right.
All right. Scott?
Yeah, just looking at Paul, one of the things that you hear a lot about is how we're developing our workforce. What does your workforce study show you about the boat building industry and what's needed?
We hear a number of different things about the skills. One is the soft skills continue to be an issue with companies.
Now, what do you mean by soft skills?
Well, new employees not having certain skills, not so much technical skills, but, you know, how to be a good employee, how to show up on time.
How to work with others.
How to work with others,
teamwork.
How to solve problems,
okay?
How to be productive in the workplace. Mm-hmm. You know, how to ask the right questions, you know, coming back from lunch on time, things like that. And so employees are generally disappointed in many of the candidates they see with the soft skills. The technical skills, we work with programs like IRIS to help train people in the technical areas. We run composites. They have a marine systems program that deals with a lot of the systems on board boats that we find very useful. But then you also have programs such as New England Tech has a marine trades program. And then MDTI in East Providence has a marine program, too, that does more outboard mechanics and things like that. So,
and we'll be talking about skills more in our next segment. I'm afraid we've run out of time for this segment. Paul Hardin of the Rhode Island Economic Development Corporation, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Scott.
Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, we're holding on to you again for when we return. We'll talk about the future of the boat industry and specifically the workforce. This is a special program looking at the state of the boat building industry as part of our series, One Square Mile Bristol, recorded at the Bristol Elks Lodge on the waterfront. You're listening to Rhode Island Public Radio, Rhode Island's NPR. I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay, and this evening we're taking a look at the boat building industry, both in Bristol and in Rhode Island. We continue the conversation looking to the future. Joining us is Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, and Clark Poston, Vice President of IRIS School of Technology and Trades. Clark, first of all, tell us what IRIS stands for and what you do.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. IRIS is a trade school. We teach technical skills and career skills for people who want to join the building workforce. We started out in the marine industry, and hence the name IRIS, which stands for the International Yacht Restoration School. So we have a two-year yacht restoration program, which focuses on wooden plank-on-frame hull restoration, boats that would have been built at Harishoff Manufacturing Company. And now we have a marine systems program and a composites technology program. So we took the words away from the letters, and now we call ourselves IRIS, the Technology and Trade School.
So one day you have Clark here training the next generation of boat builders.
Thank goodness.
Rhode Island, as you know, has a long history, three centuries or more of boat building experience. But it looks like the workforce is starting to get some gray hair, particularly some of your skilled people. What are you hearing from your members on trying to recruit some younger folks into this business?
There actually is a big need for young people to come into the industry, and it's actually, we figured that out a long time ago. Back in the Skills Gap study we did in 2008, it was one of the glaring things that came out, that in the next 5 to 10 years there would be a mass exodus, you know, of employees that were retiring. And if one good thing came out of the recession, it was that it was just delayed. You know, the need for the employees was delayed a little bit, and it gave us the opportunity to really ramp up. And that's one of the things that Rhode Island Marine Trades Association has been focusing on, particularly actually with Iris and Clark and the people over there, to make sure that we are skilling up the young people. We've been really focusing on how we might engage the high school age people. We've helped to establish some boat building programs in different high schools, as well as bulk up others that already exist, and created several other programs, including a pre-apprenticeship program and an apprenticeship program.
So, Clark, where are the areas that IRIS is focusing its training programs?
Scott, primarily, well, let me describe something to you. If I can teach you how to build a boat, you could probably build just about anything. And following Ben Hall's comment about his workforce being able to build multiple types of products using the same technology and the same skill sets, we realize that in all three of our programs. So we focus really primarily on developing someone for a career, which means that we're training them how to go to work. What the environment looks like is important, and so that's all part of the puzzle.
And how to adapt, I take it.
Absolutely, and making sure that the skill sets are relevant to the workforce industry. And IRIS is an accredited school, which means students have access to federal financial aid. And so we maintain an industry advisory group which reviews our curriculum, our facilities, our equipment, our credentials, the way we do business, the graduate placement statistics on an annual basis. And Ben Hall sits on that committee.
Boat building, historically, I know, has been a really labor-intense industry. Now, I'm wondering, where are computers and automation and changes in the technology moving in? What areas?
Pretty much all of them, Scott. I think that the challenge for the boat builder, and when you look at our two building programs, the composites program being the modern one and the wooden boat building being the older one, the concept is to prepare the technician to operate right under the designer, interpret the design information in the case of the composites program through a computer program, and operate a 5-axis robotic router with a computer program and cut his tools like mold cam would. And then we teach them process, which is all about how you build things with composites. With the composites, you have to build the material that you're using to build the product as you build the product. And that's different from a wooden boat or a steel boat, where you would go pick up a piece of wood and put your pattern on it, cut it to shape, and fit it onto a frame. So the skill sets are very different that way. One of the reasons the 2-year wooden boat building program is 2 years, and they draw by hand on the loft floor full size, make their
own using CADs with composite and computer.
That's
design.
Exactly right. Everything is done with the CAD.
Now, what high-tech skills do those entering the workforce need these days in this industry? In other words, if some young person came to see you and said, you know, I'm really interested, this is a growing industry, I like working with my hands, I want to get the skills, and they were like in 11th grade, what would you tell them they need to study?
How to show up on time.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So we zip straight to soft skills. We move right over high-tech skills and go right to straight soft skills?
I think that most composite shops, if they don't, are going to operate soon a small CNC machine. So I think in the composites training, one of the key elements in that program needs to be a CNC machine, so they have that opportunity.
Now, when you say a CNC machine, to the layperson, what does that mean?
It's a machine that cuts material, whether it's a cloth or a fabric or a solid piece, but it basically follows the tool paths that are plugged in by the operator, which is a computer program. So it's computer-aided mechanical.
So it's not the old days of a machinist. By his lathe.
No, it's different in that there's a computer between the operator and the tool. In the old days, when you operated a lathe or some similar machine, you were pushing the stock through or, you know, making the cut, whereas this is being done by a robotic router.
So it sounds like the manufacturing is changing. It's getting more high-tech, and either you, Clark, or Wendy can answer this. Are the boats changing as well that also dictates what's needed from workers?
I think definitely. I think when you look at, I mean, we've been talking about the America's Cup. There's no better race to look at the way technology just leapt through the roof in a year. Mm-hmm. And companies like Ben's company are on the cutting edge of that. So, yes, we're in the composites world running ahead of engineering elements that can't even keep up with it in some arenas. The architectural that was mentioning is a good example of where you can't get a piece of beam. If you made a composite beam, you couldn't get it to pass code because none of the codes know what composites is.
Mm-hmm. So for those who aren't familiar with the industry, boats are now being made out of this lighter, stronger carbon fiber, which makes them different animals, and therefore workers need to know how to work in carbon fiber and not wood or aluminum.
And Catherine, it's also much cleaner for the worker. It's your processes that you're using to bake the laminate are 100% of the time now done under a vacuum, under a bag. So the operator is not really exposed to that much of the bad things that are happening during the chemical reaction. It's all underneath this plastic and pulled down in a vacuum. In some cases, it's cooked in an autoclave to increase the density of the wall thickness, which increases the strength, so you can get an even lighter weight to strength ratio out of a mast at haul spars. You have a 150-foot autoclave.
You know, we heard earlier from Ben Hall over here at Hall Spars and Rigging about how one of the ways he's prospered is by diversifying into architecture, military projects, even making chairs, as he mentioned, out of carbon fibers. So, Clark, how do you train workers for both the boat building and whatever other random jobs come down the pike?
We go sit in Ben's chairs.
Seriously.
I think the key
so
to it.
So you work with the actual builders?
Absolutely. If we're not in close communication with the builders, then we're not providing relevant training. And so we're always looking to what the industry is doing to figure out what opportunities there are for training programs and how we can keep our current running programs absolutely relevant to the workforce.
So I want to step back to a little bit about what Paul Hardin from the EDC touched on before the break, which were the soft skills. And I think you mentioned it a bit as well, Clark. Wendy, are you hearing from your members of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association that the labor pool needs work on the soft skills part, which is showing up on time?
Yeah.
Being enthusiastic.
So it's not only a marine trades issue, it's a statewide issue in all sectors. It's a national issue. It's a generational thing. I think it's about learning how to work multi-generationally, you know, interacting differently, and expectations are changing through the generations as well. But yeah, I agreed with Clark when he said, you know, that was the main thing that they should be learning in high school is how to show up on time. Yeah, any soft skills would be great. I think Clark would probably agree with me that if the soft skills were there, we would have an easier time placing people, young people in jobs, because they can get the training. They can learn the training if they are able to show up to the training.
Right. Have you thought of partnering with, for instance, Community College of Rhode Island? I was doing a recent Made in Rhode Island story down at Electric Boat, and of course they make some of the world's most sophisticated submarines, and they say they've had some success in partnering with CCRI and turning out, you know, some younger folks who do have pretty good skills, and particularly math skills and communication skills. Has this been a focus of yours at all?
We've done a couple of things in that line, and if you, Scott, do we have time for me to make one comment about Wendy's comment?
Of course we do.
Yeah. The soft skill training is very much a part of what we're doing with the students at IRIS. We've built in resume writing workshops, job interviewing skill workshops, self-presentation workshops, and they're required to give presentations in public for some of their projects. So it's an integral part of the experience of a student in any of our programs, even the high school programs. And we do work in conjunction with the community college. Also, we have articulation agreements with Roger Williams University and CCRI that allows our graduates to receive credit towards a degree. So if, for instance, you had someone tracking towards an advertising slant or a business management slant on top of their degree in our program, we have made some good connections and have credit for them.
So we're talking about this need for new workers in the boat building industry. It looks like they're going to be using some high-tech tools. So, Wendy, what kind of pay are we talking about in the boating industry?
In 2008, when we did the skills gap study, it was the average salary was over $39,400, which is actually higher than the state's average. We will know again soon what that average is again. But, you know, typically if you're coming out of high school with some minimal training, maybe a summer's worth of training or so, $8 to $12 to $15 an hour. If you graduate from IRIS, how much would you make?
We're seeing starters between $15 and $18.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon. I think the companies want to get used to the new employee and vice versa to see if it's going to be a match, because every company has a culture, and they want to see that work.
How big a component do you think on-the-job training is?
We built in an internship in the industry into every one of our programs. So they spend a month working in a company to get the experience of working in an economically driven environment. And that's been a key role. I would suggest 87% of those internships turn to full-time employment opportunities.
85?
Yes.
I was actually going to say, what is the overall placement rate for IRIS? Because I know it's incredible, and I want him to say it.
Well, we don't have trouble at that end of the spectrum. No. We pretty much get everybody to work that wants to go.
Yeah.
You're listening to a special program looking at the state of the boat building industry as part of our series One Square Mile Bristol. We're talking to Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, and Clark Poston of IRIS. I'm Catherine Welch, along with Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay. Changing gears just a bit from talking about the labor pool to what they will be making. Wendy, is diversity, is this just the future for Bristol and Rhode Island's boat building industry? Will you always have a Ben Hall making elephant gates from here on out, or will it ever roll back where they just get to make their boat parts again?
You know, I was thinking about this earlier today. Boats are made to last. These boats that are built, they could last how long? 100 years? More?
Well, we've got boats that are that old, for sure. Yeah. A lot depends on what they use to make them out of.
So we're getting a critical mass. So I don't think they'll ever necessarily be, you know, a huge production of boats again. But boats will never go away, will they?
No, and I think the industry, like Paul had suggested, there's two primary sectors, which includes the repair sector and the maintenance. So you've got a multifaceted industry in Rhode Island.
All right.
Yeah. People love boats.
So I'm going to ask you, too, to look into your crystal ball. I'll start with Wendy. Where do you see the state's boat building industry 10 years from now?
Well, the Rhode Island Marine Trades Association just updated its mission statement, and I'm actually going to tell you what it is. Growing the Rhode Island marine industry through advocacy, education, and promotion. But our vision is to position Rhode Island as a worldwide leader in the marine industry. And that's exactly where I see us in 10 years, a leader.
Clark?
I think as long as our boat builders and our companies focus on two primary things, high-end custom objects and diversity, so that you are not standing your whole business onto one mast, to use a pun, you know, with Ben. But I think I think those two elements are the primary elements. I think if you're building very high-end custom products, whether they're boats or other things, then your survivability is going to be high. And I don't think we're going to see a big production per se boat building segment come back to New England. I think that'll stay in states where the labor rate is different, the cost of living is much less, and things like that. But I don't think that's our business anyway. I mean, Herrschoff Manufacturing Company built an awful lot of boats, and they were all pretty much custom, mm-hmm. even if he did a class of, 400 S boats. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I think, custom work. I think that's the answer.
Agreed.
This program is part of our series, One Square Mile, looking at Bristol. And before we go, I'd like to hear from both of you. What's your favorite thing about Bristol?
When are you first?
I'm going to say Cogshill Farm Museum. I'm on the board there, and I'm very proud of what they're doing over there.
Clark?
I think probably the little fishing restaurant down on the wharf over the harbor, Quito's.
Quito's.
Yeah, Quito's, yeah. I would have thought you would have said Iris.
We just got here.
Well, your modesty is commendable. Thank you. Well, we've covered a lot of ground tonight, and so I would like to thank our guests, Wendy Mackey, CEO of the Rhode Island Marine Trade Association, Clark Poston, Vice President of Iris, Paul Hardin of the EDC, and Ben Hall of Hall Spars and Rigging, and Rhode Island Public Radio's Scott McKay. Many thanks to the folks at the Bristol Elks Lodge, 1860. Also, thank you to audio engineer Mike LaMancha, Rhode Island Public Radio engineer Aaron Reed, and general manager Joe O'Connor. I'm Catherine Welch. This is Rhode Island Public Radio, Rhode Island's NPR.